Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good evening and welcome to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. It's taken me a bit of time to get used to saying good evening instead of good afternoon since we swapped to our new 6 p.m. slot here on Premier Christian Radio for Unbelievable. But glad to have you with me for what is going to be a really interesting show on cancel culture today. I'll introduce my guests in just a moment's time, but you may be listening somewhere else in the world than the UK at any time of the day or night via our podcast, or even watching via our YouTube channel. Today's show is available over at youtube.com. Look for the Premier Unbelievable Show channel, and you can find all the links, of course, from our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to the newsletter too, a great way to keep in touch with the show. We'll even send you a free ebook when you subscribe. And if you'd like to support the show financially, we'll send you all of the sessions from Unbelievable USA from last year. Can't believe that was nearly a year ago, actually, that we were out there. It's a bank holiday weekend here in the UK. It means we get a little bit of extra time off just at the end of the summer. Probably the equivalent of something like the Labor Day weekend or something in the US. But it's great to have you with me wherever you are listening from. We've got some of your feedback to those recent shows we did on racism, Black Lives Matter and the church. So listen out for some of that towards the end of today's show. But for now, let's get right into it as we discuss today's cultural topic.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Really looking forward to the conversation that I'm bringing you on Unbelievable today. I've titled it The Great Awakening, Cancel Culture and the J.K. Rowling Affair. Now, of course, J.K. Rowling was among a number of high-profile signatories to the now infamous Harper's Magazine letter over the summer, which stated that the free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. And many would say it's because of the rise of a certain sort of unquestionable new orthodoxies that have emerged around race, gender and sexuality that they claim are suppressing free speech. Well, Rowling herself has come under intense criticism for a series of tweets and articles critiquing current transgender ideology from a feminist perspective. But it's led to this huge backlash and many of her fan base disavowing her, even caused a near mutiny at her publisher over her next children's book. But the question is, are we in the grip of this left-wing, unforgiving cancel culture? Or is the right wing just as responsible for the culture wars that presently exist? I can see one of my guests nodding enthusiastically to that second proposition, because I'm joined by Jonathan Pierce and David French today, both new to the show, but great to have you both on, gentlemen. Little introduction to you both, first of all. David French, my Christian guest, is senior editor at The Dispatch, a conservative-leaning news and commentary website. And his article, America is in the Grip of a Fundamentalist Revival, but it's not Christian, examined the quasi-religious nature of woke politics. David, I should say, is also the author of a forthcoming book, Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat and How to Restore Our Nation. And my atheist guest today is philosopher Jonathan Pierce, who blogs as a tippling philosopher on the Pathos Network. He's recently been blogging on cancel culture and says that claims that the radical left is suppressing speech are very overblown, and any such efforts are actually mild in comparison to the organized lobbying of the right wing. So I think we should have an interesting discussion today. I'm not sure how much disagreement we may necessarily have, actually, between you both, but I'm looking forward to to having the conversation. So, David, let's introduce you first and hear a little bit about you. You're the senior editor for The Dispatch. Tell us what The Dispatch is, first of all.
The Dispatch is a new conservative media publication here in the United States, and it is our mission is to take a pause from clickbait, take a pause from the news cycle, and try to engage in a closer look with fact-based opinion and analysis. So our aim is to reach out to those people who are really tired of the hot take, and to instead who are craving a serious, in-depth look at the news. And we're founded by conservatives, but we're not partisan. In other words, we're many of us are, for example, I would call myself a former Republican, now independent, but I'm conservative. And so that's our goal, is to end the dependence on clickbait. And so we've been very gratified at the success so far. There's a real hunger out there for people who want a longer look at what's happening and a deeper and more searching look at what's happening in our country and culture.
Yeah, well, it's a very worthy goal, the end of clickbait. I'm not sure if you can...
It's difficult.
That's a Goliath that you're tackling there, yes. That's for sure. Tell us a little bit about this book that's coming out. And for those who don't know, you are quite well known in the circles you move in for being a never-Trumper.
Right.
But you've got a book that's obviously very prescient for the forthcoming election on the issue of politics and the division in the USA. So just a little detail on this book coming out in September.
Yeah, so the book is called Divided We Fall. You can order it on Amazon.com right now. It's coming out September 22nd. And essentially, it's making the argument that we cannot take it for granted that the United States will continue as a united country, that our divisions are extraordinarily profound, that there is no single truly important religious, cultural, social, or political trend that is pulling us together more than it's pushing us apart, and that we have to do something to arrest this. We cannot continue to act as if our unity can be taken for granted. And I take a look at a number of factors that are pushing us apart further and further and further. I posit ways in which we could actually divide. People have asked me, how is that even possible? So in the middle part of the book, I posit the ways that it could actually happen. And in the final part of the book, I say, here's what we need to do to retain our union. And the short answer to that is we need to understand that this is a pluralistic nation, that there are a variety of different voices in this country, and that we need to quote the musical Hamilton, quoting George Washington, quoting the Bible. there's this memorable phrase from the Book of Micah that George Washington used almost 50 times in his writing, that every man shall sit under his own vine and his own fig tree, and no one shall make him afraid. And that is essentially that you can have a place here in the United States, that if you're atheist, if you're Christian, if you're white, if you're black, if you're gay, if you're straight, you can have a place here in the United States of America. And if we cannot embrace that as a vision and instead move towards a model of domination and exclusion, then we're going to have real strains on our union.
Gosh, well, that...
Perhaps you just need to cancel Twitter.
Well, that would be a start.
Yes. Well, I was going to say that what the book is tackling is an even bigger Goliath than clickbait, that's for sure.
Yes, for sure.
So welcome to the show anyway, David. I look forward to seeing the book when it comes out. I'll make sure there's a link to it and The Dispatch from today's show. Welcome also, Jonathan, to the program. Great to have you on. We've sort of moved in similar-ish circles for a long time, so I'm surprised it's taken this long to get you on the show, actually, because we're both in the UK and we move in similar kind of atheist/apologetic type circles. But tell us a little bit of yourself and why you run a blog called A Tippling Philosopher, which is a fascinating sounding title.
Well, actually, that comes from, goodness me, it must be over sort of 12 years ago or something. Some friends and I decided to start a sort of monthly philosophy group at a pub where we would go down and drink beer and do philosophy and pick a subject and take it to town. And we are called the Tippling Philosophers. And since I am one of them, I am a Tippling Philosopher. So that kind of stuck. It seemed a pretty decent name for the blog, and I've been blogging now at Patheos for a good few years on the non-religious channel there. But you know, when you've written over 3,000 blog posts, you start thinking, well, I think I've said most of what I need to say about God. and so I'm becoming more and more interested in politics, actually, which is a subset of morality and therefore, you know, philosophy. So it's all connected, and the intersection of politics and religion is, as I'm sure David understands, is particularly interesting, specifically with regard to America. So
yeah, I mean, I'm interested by the fact that while I know atheists who would be of one mind when it comes to their attitude towards religion and so on, frequently those atheists might have quite divergent views actually on culture and ideology and that sort of thing. And you saw, I think, to some extent, the new atheists sort of go in different directions when it came to how to actually institute a better culture and world. They agreed that God doesn't exist, but there was a lot of disagreement on exactly how to run things thereafter.
Yeah, you had the whole Atheism Plus movement. But I think what's interesting and pertinent to this discussion is the intellectual dark web, where you've got certain members of the atheist community sort of butting heads with the more leftist side of the community. And you know, people often say that it's like herding cats trying to unify atheists. And it's actually the same with the left. And that's part of the problem I think we might come onto tonight, which is the right can have this unified sort of approach, and the left and atheists are just always trying to attack each other or don't have that unification that I think they would profit from if they want to get things achieved for the benefit of them and hopefully for everyone.
Yeah, just before we get into the discussion, what do you teach philosophy? What's your sort of
no? So I'm now between jobs actually. So okay. I'm coming out of teaching and I do a lot of writing. I've just worked on a book on natural law. A great criticism of natural law theory by Günter Lehr, and that's a fantastic book. I've been writing fiction, so I've just finished my sequel to a book on a pandemic. So the first one I wrote sort of a few years back, Survival of the Fittest, Metamorphosis, and now I've got to kind of weave in this pandemic into how the story goes, as if I knew this pandemic was always there type thing. So,
gosh,
so yeah, it's trying to make the writing work. Yeah. I've written a lot of books on atheism and whatnot, so we'll see what the future holds, eh?
Yes, well, lovely to meet you and to have you on the show at long last, Jonathan. I'll make sure, as I say, links to both the blogs I've mentioned from today's show, but we're here to talk about the Great Awakening, cancel culture. J.K. Rowling may figure as well in the course of our conversation. Tell us a bit about this article you wrote for the Dispatch then, David. America is in the grip of a fundamentalist revival. What kind of a fundamentalist revival were you talking about?
Yeah, so for my article, it was there's an awakening and a trumpening. So there's something happening on the right, and there's something happening on the left. And it was based around a tweet that I tweeted out that I said, I don't think you can really understand our political moment and our cultural moment in the United States fully unless you've had real experience either studying or being a part of a fundamentalist religious movement. And I grew up in a movement and a religious movement that had very strong fundamentalist and sectarian elements to it, experienced fundamentalism up close. And I reason why I said fundamentalism is there is a difference between religion and fundamentalist religion. And that's a long and complex topic, but I tried to make it as simple as I could. And I said, essentially, when you're talking about the difference between fundamentalism and religion and fundamentalist religion is the presence or absence of existential humility. The question, do you have a question or a doubt, or do you have doubts in your mind about truth claims? Do you have questions in your mind? Do you have sort of an existential humility about, can I figure all of this out? Do I really know all that I need to know? And, you know, so I'm much more familiar with the Christian side of this. And, you know, there are multiple scriptures that indicate that there is knowledge known only to God. For example, you know, Apostle Paul writes about that we see through a glass darkly. We know in part. And so that existential humility, which is a command actually in Micah 6:8, says, what does the Lord require of you? It's seek justice, love, mercy, walk humbly before the Lord your God. That existential humility has a leavening effect on any movement, if it understands it and embraces it. But fundamentalism often lacks that existential humility. We have figured it out. You should be able to as well. If you haven't, it is an unmistakable sign of a very serious moral defect. And there should be some punishment taken. So for example, in the tradition that I grew up in, if a church in that denomination, they wouldn't really call themselves a denomination, so it's more appropriate to call it a sect. If a church built a gymnasium, for example, well, that was not what a church should do. And so therefore, not only did you have to disfellowship from the church that built a denomination, you had to disfellowship from everyone who would not disfellowship from the church that built the gymnasium. Sounds a lot like cancel culture, right? It sounds like, hey, instead of agreeing to disagree or agreeing to try to persuade each other and accommodate each other's differences, there had to be punitive action taken against the heretical belief. And so the point that I was trying to make is that on the far ends of the left and the far ends of the right, there is an impulse towards punitive action against dissent, as opposed to persuasive action against in the face of disagreement. And so some of the paradigmatic examples of that would be, for example, on the left, when Google fired this guy named James Damore after he expressed points of view about how to diversify Google's workforce without engaging in gender discrimination. And all these people on the right were saying, look at those intolerant Silicon Valley leftists. You know, Google asked for input from employees. James Damore gave input and he's terminated for it. That's so intolerant. And then look at how intolerant the left is. And then, you know, Colin Kaepernick takes a knee, a peaceful act of dissent and protest during the national anthem. And Donald Trump, you know, says, fire them, about all these football players. And does the right say, no, no, that's cancel culture? No, the right cheered along with that declaration. And so what I submit is that you have on one end of the left and on one end of the right, you have movements that are culturally and often legally illiberal in that they are seeking to impose a particular worldview by domination rather than persuasion. And that's the essence of what's happening on two ends of the political spectrum. I think of cancel culture as a bipartisan phenomenon. I think of it as most frequently fratricidal. So in other words, most canceling you're going to see is left canceling left and right canceling right. Occasionally it crosses the streams. And one of the hallmarks of cancel culture, in my view, is the notion that a person who engages in speech that I don't like must receive a particular form of punishment, whether it's a loss of a job, loss of a speaking opportunity, as opposed to criticism. None of us are immune from criticism. There has to be a goal towards a punitive action. And that, I think, is the thing that marks what I would call cancel culture more than anything else. Is there a goal to punish in a tangible way the dissenter? And as I said, you see it on the right and you see it on the left, and it's mostly fratricidal.
I think where we're not going to agree on a number of things. And I think where we do agree is that where it does happen, this is a case of authoritarianism on the left and the right. And it doesn't help when you don't have a very comfortable spot for the center ground. So in America, you have a bipartisan, you have a two-party system, which means that you're going to get a polarization of voters, of the electorate, and that becomes very tribalistic. And there's no kind of center ground safe space, if you like, for people who don't sit nicely into those two tribes. Whereas in Britain, that's been changing over the years. We were very much a two-party system. Now we're a much more plural electoral landscape, pluralistic. But I do agree with you. But I think this is a talk really about polarization that can be solved by reforming the election in America. But when's that going to happen? And I think we might agree on being able to change this by people within the in-group, So it's very difficult to change people's minds if you are from the other side of the fence. In psychology, it's a backfire effect. You're much more likely to entrench someone. I mean, this is the nature of Unbelievable podcasts, right? Is you've got a Christian and atheist arguing and no one's going to change their mind because actually you just entrench in your original positions. But it's a good fun thing to do anyway. So the idea is that when you want to change someone's mind, you need to be from within that their camp, just marginally different. And you need to nudge people away from their position. And maybe that's something that I think David has been sort of hinting at rather than a full frontal assault from the other side. Yeah. But my points about the cancel culture situation, and I know we won't have time to talk about this, but I broadly have 8 points to make, and I'll really quickly run through.
Yeah, go on then.
First of all, if you're going to make claims about a cancel culture being a problem, so David talks about we're being in the grips of this at the moment, you need to provide some data. So what's the data that there's a positive trend towards this and the actual real numbers of this happening, of successful cancelling? Because otherwise it looks like my point two, which is a culture wars narrative perpetuated by the right. So the right wing is very good at creating a culture wars narrative. Republicans do it every single election, and that's how they get in. If they do it well, they get voted in. So for me, this is all part of that. And it's because by point number three, it happens on the right as much as it does on the left, possibly even more. It's just not labeled as cancel culture. Point number four would be there are many hypocrites of those who claim to be signing the letter, even other people who've been cancelled are themselves, people who have done so themselves. Point number five, there are many examples of cancel culture which aren't actually cancel culture. And I have a bone to pick with David about that. So okay. One of his main
examples. We'll come back to that then. Okay.
Point number six is freedom of speech. So the people who are supposedly cancelled end up having a bigger platform than they did originally and are not really cancelled and are very well able to spread their message. Point number seven is the freedom of speech for the people who are on Twitter claiming, you know, criticizing these people, holding them to account for what they do and say, that is their freedom of speech. They are free to say that. It's a freedom of speech issue there as well. And my final point, point number eight, is chronocentrism. The idea that this is suddenly a big problem. It's always been a big problem. People have always been fundamentally moralistic. What has changed is mass social media. What has changed is the fact that all humans in the Western culture now have the ability to publicize their voice and their moral opinions. So that's what's changed. I don't think we're becoming far more moralistic. We're just more able to voice that publicly.
You'll never make a Baptist preacher because you should only ever have 3 points if you're.
And
so I know we Baptist, won't cover that.
But a Baptist preacher would have done the 3 points in 45 minutes.
Well, right, exactly. Yeah. And they would all have alliterated as well, of course. all really interesting points. And as you say, we may not have time to cover every one of them, course. Jonathan, but lots of.
I don't
of
mean to scattergun, but those, they are really, really.
Well, do any of those particularly stick out as important critiques of those who say there is this aggressive cancel culture on the left? David, what would you say in response to one or two of those points?
Well, one thing I do think it is very difficult to empirically quantify this. I do think that, for example, especially, and I do think it's also primarily an elite phenomenon. And we cannot, let's just go ahead and say, nobody's canceling J.K. Rowling. She's uncancelable. But I think part of the point of, say, her signing on was, and many of the people who signed on to the letter are basically uncancelable as well. They have these just enormous platforms. It's to give, to use their platforms to lend opposition to the notion that dissent should be met with punitive action.
But would it be fair to say, for instance, with J.K. Rowling, since you mentioned her, that it'll be very unlikely that you'll see her being nominated as the patron of major charities anymore in the UK because she'll be seen as too hot, too. So there's a sense in which.
Well, you would know that more than me.
She will still have her.
But there's an argument there's an argument to say that's right, because there's an argument to say that people should be held to account for their views. I mean, this is the whole point about this so-called phenomenon of cancel culture. Actually, the other side of the coin is that these are people that are holding holding other people, these with huge platforms, to account for what they say. Now, if it is the case that J.K. Rowling, and I do believe that she was wrong, she didn't use any citations in her essay, she used poor sources, she mischaracterized a whole load of things, I think she did a bad job, and I think she should be held to account for her views. What I think is going on with this whole scenario is not many people understand trans issues. They don't even understand really the nomenclature and what it stands for. And so with uncertainty becomes a right moral mess of some people attacking other people and other people not really knowing what's going on and liking J.K. Rowling, so standing up for her because they like her books, and a load of cognitive dissonance going on. And so it just becomes a really messy episode.
What do you think? Yeah, David.
I think there are certain people who have a platform of such size and power that talking about the marginal loss of maybe an honorary degree from somewhere or, a enhanced level, you know, a hashtag cancel J.K. Rowling, etc. I think that's beside the point. I think the much more on point, it's a story, for example, like a woman, a Jordanian-American woman named Natasha Tynes. This is one of these things that kind of passes through the news cycle in a way that few people remember it. But this is a woman who briefly tweeted a picture of a woman on the metro, a metro official breaking metro rules by eating on the train in the Washington, D.C. subway, called the Metro. Tweeted it briefly. Deleted the tweet, and then all of, you know, this Twitter pile-on comes on her. And what ends up happening, she had a book that was about to be published. Her publisher cancels publication of the book. This is a person who's never really been in the public eye. If you Google her, this is what comes up. She suffered serious psychological after effects of this, even fled the country for a while. You know, this is the kind of thing we're talking about.
I think it's worth, there's a bit of pushback on that case, though, because on that case, and she's one of my examples of hypocrisy. So Natasha Tynes literally tried to get someone sacked. So her original tweet was this, and some people say it was racist. So there's a black person on the metro. She says, this person's breaking metro rules. She shamed her publicly on Twitter and basically was calling for her to be punished. Exactly what you're saying, punitive measure for her. So here is someone who is trying to cancel someone else, ending up getting canceled herself, and then moaning about cancel culture.
Well, she tweets so, it, she but deletes also, it. She tweets it, she deletes it, realizing that she did something wrong. And then
she also didn't get her book canceled. The book distributors did fulfill their contract. So again, you know,
Dollar lawsuit is filed.
Yeah. And okay.
So the problem you have here is, again, you know, so you'll have a situation where a person who's really, are they public figure in any way, shape, or form? No, they're not. Do they make a mistake? Yeah, they make a mistake. Is the response proportionate to what they did? Absolutely not. You know, and this is what we're you know, talking about when we're talking about cancel culture, is a disproportionate, not critique, not just critique, hey, this was wrong, but a disproportionate, overwhelming response. And that, to me, is part of the toxic that we talked to, you know, you joked earlier about Twitter. You know, the idea that normal, average, everyday people can start trending nationally and sometimes internationally on Twitter, often by from a snippet of their life or a bad tweet or, you know, this or that viral video. To me, those are the things that the J.K. Rowling stuff makes headlines because, good grief, it's J.K. Rowling. And I mean, you know, anytime she makes news, she just makes news. But when we're talking about some of these other individuals, that's where, you know, non-public figures who become public because of a bad tweet or a bad video. I mean, these kinds of things have real massive negative effects on people's lives. And I think we just need to cool it. And then the other thing that ends up happening is this has a sort of a broader chilling effect. I mean, the idea that, for example, I had a Yale professor come up and talk to me not long ago, and he said, you know, I'm terrified of my own students and what they can do to me through Twitter. And that's a problem.
Fascinating stuff. We're going to go to a quick break, and I'll be interested to hear Jonathan's responses to that in just a moment's time. We'll continue talking about, I think I'll mention some more of this Harper's letter and some of the concerns that were laid out in it. And we'll talk about why there was such a big backlash to it as well. We're talking about cancel culture, the Great Awakening, the J.K. Rowling affair on Unbelievable today. My guests are David French and Jonathan Pierce. Come back in just a moment's time.
Believers and non-believers will all be helped, says Tim Keller, a wonderfully clear and accessible case for Christianity from a man who has hosted many of the world's most prominent skeptics and atheists, says Andrew Wilson. Beautifully written, brilliantly argued, will thrill and challenge, says R.T. Kendall. Unbelievable, the book by Justin Brierley. Download a free chapter and find out how it can help you make the case for Christ. Unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, welcome back to today's show. We're talking about the Great Awakening, cancel culture, and the J.K. Rowling affair. We're doing this in the company of my Christian guest, David French, and my atheist guest, philosopher, Jonathan Pierce. Do check out both their blogs, by the way. TheDispatch.com is for the website that David French is senior editor at, and Pathios.com/blog/tippling for a tippling philosopher's bit on the Pathios website. J.K. Rowling, you know, makes the news because she's J.K. Rowling, as you've said, David. And I've been watching with interest some of the times she's put her head above the parapet and decided to, you know, speak out in ways that are inevitably going to be unpopular. It could be argued that if she just kept posting nice pictures and talking about Harry Potter, you know, she might not be making a rod for her own back. But she's obviously decided this is an important enough issue that she's willing to bear the inevitable criticism that comes her way. I'm guessing, Jonathan, you would say, well, that is just what it means to live in a free culture. People are going to criticize you if you're a large personality.
So the idea that you should be accountable for what you say, especially if you're in a position of power, right? Because your platform is that much larger. And I do agree with David that actually these issues of real cancel culture, when it does happen, are far more serious when you are not someone with such a big platform, because of course, you know, you stand to lose so much more. So I do agree with that. However, it's just so hard to say how much this is actually happening. And it goes back to, I think the whole thing is massively overblown. I'm not denying cancel culture doesn't ever happen. It does happen at times. But what I am saying is it is very overblown, and particularly by the right, who will point and shout at cancel culture happening as part of their culture wars.
But what's interesting for me, Jonathan, if I'll read a bit of the Harper's letter, because in a way, I wouldn't describe Harper's magazine, not that I know it that well, but I don't think it's a right-wing publication.
And no, there's nothing wrong with the Harper's letter.
Well, let me read out some of what it says, and we'll just get both of your takes on this. So it says, this is just a section of it. It said, the free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. While we have come to expect this on the radical right, censoriousness is also spreading more widely in our culture, an intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues in a blinding moral certainty. We uphold the value of robust and even caustic counter-speech from all quarters, but it is now all too common to hear calls for swift and severe retribution in response to perceived transgressions of speech and thought. More troubling still, institutional leaders, in a spirit of panicked damage control, are delivering hasty and disproportionate punishments instead of considered reforms. Editors are fired for running controversial pieces. Books are withdrawn for alleged inauthenticity. Journalists are barred from writing on certain topics. Professors are investigated for quoting works of literature in class. A researcher is fired for circulating a peer-reviewed academic study. And the heads of organisations are ousted for what are sometimes just clumsy mistakes. Whatever the arguments around each particular incident, the result has been to steadily narrow the boundaries of what can be said without the threat of reprisal. We are already paying the price in greater risk aversion among writers, artists, and journalists who fear for their livelihoods if they depart from the consensus or even lack sufficient zeal in agreement. Now, again, lots of signatories to that. J.K. Rowling, we've mentioned Steven Pinker, Noam Chomsky, Margaret Atwood, Malcolm Gladwell. None of these names to me speak of a kind of, the far right sort of movement. It seems that within what is traditionally a kind of left progressive kind of culture and academia, there is a significant worry here, Jonathan. So what are your thoughts on that? And we'll get from David.
Actually, those signatories are a bit all over the place. So there's a very interesting collection of people, some who have, like Barry Weiss, tried to cancel people herself. Again, it goes back to this sort of hypocrisy of some of the signatories. But it goes back to this idea of chronocentrism, which is the idea, while we have to expect this on the radical right, censoriousness is also spreading more widely in our culture, and intolerance to opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism. We used to burn people at the stake. Blasphemy, heresy. It's like, people have forgotten where we've come from, and people have forgotten the fundamentalist religious nature of some of our history. To say that, this is all, it's terrible now, look at what's happening. We can say these things, and you might get attacked on Twitter, but you're not getting burnt at the stake. You're not, it can go wrong. It's a bumpy road sometimes, but just because there's a bumpy road on a journey to somewhere better, you don't need to get out the car, ditch the keys, and walk back home. Actually, that destination is a worthy place, of moral progress. And we might get it wrong a couple of times, but you've got to stick at it and learn from those mistakes.
David, what's your thoughts?
No, I think I like that for the chronocentrism. We have a generation now that the historical memory is exactly as long as the first page of the Google search, which privileges recent results. There are people who say to me, it has never been more intolerant in higher education than it is now. And I remember the early 1990s, I went to law school at Harvard Law School. I went from a small, very conservative evangelical college in Tennessee to Harvard Law School. And if Twitter existed in 1991 to 1994, Harvard would have trended every week because it was nuts on campus. It was the political intensity was off the charts. Screaming and yelling and shouting down in class, takeovers of the administration building over faculty diversity. People writing, I formed a pro-life group and at the law school. And one of the first notes I got when I sent out a message was, why don't you go die, you effing fascist? I'm not going to call it a death threat. Okay. Not a death threat. It's a death aspiration. I'm not going to
let me to laugh.
I'm not going to kill you. I want something to do it or someone. And so it was very, very intense. It was so intense. There was an article written, I believe it was in GQ or Esquire, one of the big men's magazines, that called Harvard Law School the Beirut on the Charles. And this is back when Beirut was as deadly as like Mosul or Fallujah or Raqqa. And so these things happen, and they've come and gone. The founding generation, the founding fathers passed the Alien and Sedition Acts after they enacted the First Amendment. And the Alien and Sedition Acts were some of the most speech repressive federal statutes ever to have been drafted. And so I totally get exactly what Jonathan is saying, but in each generation, we have an obligation, those of us who seek to preserve a small L liberal republic. And that is, do you push against censoriousness in favor of pluralism? Or do you give in to authoritarianism? And we certainly have a milder form of authoritarianism so far than you've seen in other times in American history. My goodness, people who hear about Woodrow Wilson sort of for the first time and the way he clamped down on dissent in the United States of America on its way into World War I, they can't believe that this happened in the United States of America. So it has been worse in the past. I think it's our obligation right now to make sure that it doesn't, even though it's not as bad, that it doesn't get worse in our present generation. And the other thing is, social media magnifies this to such a degree that we often believe things are worse than they really are. And it makes us anxious as if it was that bad.
And I think partly it is the window we're looking at it very often through social media that does magnify it. And it does give us the ability to get involved in business that we would never have had the foggiest clue about. You know, I now know all about Evergreen State University and the Brett Weinstein affair and all that. If 10 years ago, even, I would probably never have come across that controversy. But the social media aspect of it does allow everyone to pile in with their opinions and with their condemnation, even if it doesn't necessarily have, you know, the same effect that burning someone at the stake would have, you know.
But I do think possibly we've failed to actually define what cancel culture is, because I think there's the idea that cancel culture is just people shouting on Twitter for people to be cancelled, rather than people actually being cancelled. And I think that's is a really important distinction there, because, I was watching a news article on cancel culture on YouTube recently, and the news person defined cancel culture as no longer accepted among woke society. It's literally how she defined it. So it's could only happen on the left, because it's just not being accepted by woke society. You're not actually being cancelled, you're just not being accepted by people on Twitter. To me, that's not cancel culture. Cancel culture should be a culture of people actually being cancelled.
Well, presumably you think there are genuine examples, though, of it not just people being shouted out on Twitter, but where their actual academic freedoms are. And, you know, obviously the Harper's letter thinks there are some issues of genuine cancellation
there have been
going
people
on.
Right. I mean, there have been people who've been fired, like the Harper's letter references the David Shore controversy when he tweeted out a study indicating that nonviolent protest is more effective than violent protest at achieving political aims. And he was he lost his job. Now, I do think there is, and I think Jonathan is right, there is a difference between an attempted and a completed cancellation. For example, there have a lot of people who've attempted to cancel me because of my opposition to Trump. They have attempted to get me fired from particularly when I was a senior writer in National Review. People wanted me fired and they tried to get me fired and I never was fired. And so there's a difference between an attempted cancellation and a completed cancellation. Absolutely. My view is I'm opposed to the attempted and the completed cancellation. I would say to my critics who wanted me fired from National Review, hey, come at me hard about why I'm wrong, about what I'm getting wrong about Donald Trump, about why I'm misjudging his character, misjudging his policies. Let's have that confrontation. Let's have that fight. But saying I need to be unemployed or lose that employer as a result of that opinion, I think that's a bridge too far. Not in every circumstance. That's not to say that every single expression is in bounds. But I like the way Nick Christakis, who's from Yale, who was subject to his own literal viral video where a group of people literally gathered around him to yell at him over his wife's speech, actually, at Yale a few years ago. And he defined cancel culture in, I think, an interesting way, which is, you know, he's saying essentially he's asking a few questions. One is, Is the attempt at punishment, or is the attack going beyond disagreement and going towards punitive action? In other words, is it disproportionate to the offense? And is the speech that is being engaged with, or the speech where they're, to use Jonathan's phrase, where people are trying to, quote, hold them accountable, is it broadly within the Overton window? And the Overton window, I don't know if this term has made it to the UK very much.
I'm not familiar with it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a great term. So essentially, it's coined by a guy from a conservative think tank some years ago called the Mackinac Center. And it's essentially the window of acceptable discourse. And the Overton window shifts and moves over time. So there was a time in which eugenic scientific racism was in the Overton window and is now blessedly out of it. And a lot of our cultural battles over where is that window? What are the boundaries of that window? And it will move, and it does move. And it's a good thing that it moves. But there is speech that's within it and without it. And a lot of the cancellation that people are concerned about isn't so much like the, you know, your import to America, Milo Yiannopoulos. I don't know. You know, Milo Yiannopoulos got canceled. Milo Yiannopoulos was thoroughly canceled, but he was way outside the Overton window.
Someone like Milo, you sense, was just saying things to get a reaction, to kind of be controversial. And I think where Jonathan, some people are concerned is that people who are trying to have a reasonable conversation and say things right. that might go against the currently fashionable or the prevailing orthodoxy that might only really exist in certain particular parts of the culture, they're suddenly being told they can't say those things. So for instance, I can imagine plenty of people disagree with you on your blog and you welcome it in the comments for people to have a good conversation with you. But you'd be a bit annoyed if they went to the editors of Pathos and said, you should get rid of that blog because he's saying things I don't like and disagree with. So there's got to be a point at which you think there is a cancellation sort of culture that's not so good in this regard.
Well, this is where you've got to trust, hopefully, people to make the right decisions. Of course, that doesn't always happen, but there are examples where people have been. So Alex Morse is a Democratic mayor in America who was just had a political hit job done on him by corporate Democrats. So he was going for the congressional primaries and they basically lied about him and then he got cancelled. But he got cancelled for arguably the right reasons, but they were lies. And so the wrong procedures didn't take place and people didn't fact check and it wasn't due process. So we have a situation of arguably it might not be defined as cancel culture because he's rightfully got rid of, but for lies. It's really problematic.
Is that part of the problem, though, that David outlined? Is there's a sense of it's all
people are like, quick
people
to
have
judge.
To be yeah they have to be out of their job within 24 hours or else the employer is going to get a lot of heat and it doesn't lend itself to a kind of sober investigation, let's say, of whether these are genuinely people who have done something really wrong.
But David himself, so he used in his article the example of Calhoun, the CEO of Boeing, right, for the supposedly being cancelled.
PR executive,
PR executive, sorry, you're mm-hmm. right. And I looked into this and thought, hang on, this is a bit weird because...
Just to explain what that is for those who haven't heard it, what was the background to that?
So the background is this. So the PR executive for Boeing had only been in job, I think, 6 months and ended up having a complaint made about him because of an article he had written 30 years ago about women not being on the front line in the forces. So he had since rescinded that opinion and blah, blah, blah. But he then resigned from his position at PR executive. So that's a big old job. And this is what David used as one of his examples of cancel culture. I'm like, I'm sorry, I just don't buy this. No one on that big a job gets cancelled for one single employee complaining. So it turns out that actually, when you looked at the details, he had a really controversial remuneration package, that he'd been blaming pilots for the 737 crashes, that he was pretty unpopular, that he was, so on and so forth. And you think, actually, this is Boeing using the excuse of cancel culture to offload a PR executive who'd only been in the job 6 months, was pretty unlikable by all accounts. But this then the right wing media could pile on and say cancel culture, cancel culture, cancel culture. And everyone goes, it's another example. Oh, look at the left. This is liberal left. And it's not. And this is why it's so important to understand this is part of the narrative, of the culture wars narrative that the Republicans peddle every single election cycle. And that is a huge point for me because so many things here are about overblowing what is really happening. I'm not denying it does happen at times. I just think it's
inflated. David, any response to that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of these situations, what ends up happening is you take a dive into it, and this is something I used to do employment law quite a bit back in my previous. Back when I was a full-time litigator. And one of the interesting things you have about employment law in employment situations is virtually any person, when you dive down deep into the details of their employment, you're going to find they did this poorly or they did that poorly. And it's a very big fight over whether or not the complaint, whether it's race discrimination or gender discrimination, et cetera, is the actual proximate cause of the termination. And so that's one of these things that you find a lot in these cancel culture fights is you'll have an initial report that seems very clear. Then you have a follow-on look that muddies the water. And at the very end of the day, you're left with, I don't know, because they don't end up getting litigated, or they do get litigated and we don't hear about the final results for 18, 24, 36 months. I think that in the Boeing example, which seemed there was an enormous amount of reporting when it first came out, nearly unanimous, that this article from 33 years ago was a material factor, maybe not the only factor, but a material factor in the departure from his job. Was it the only factor? Was it the principal factor? Was it any factor at all? These are things that I think, if you're going to have post-employment litigation, you'd sort out. But I do think, and I think Jonathan's right to want to dive deep into each one of these circumstances and to take a close look, not just accept the face value of the story. But I think that the bottom line that we're dealing with is that many of these circumstances where there's a quote unquote rest of the story, when you actually look at them, you'll see people who've engaged in very similar conduct who did not have the quote unquote offensive speech who stay at the workplace, who remain at the workplace. And so you can always sort of complicate it, but the bottom line is, was the offensive speech the tipping point or not? One of the interesting aspects of, for example, the James Damore situation at Google was that he, this is again the guy who argued that there are reasons other than gender discrimination why there are fewer women in programming, and here are things that Google can do to try to redress that situation. And yeah, Google had a lot of evidence that there were people who were upset by that, and they were angry at his speech that he engaged. He floated those ideas, one of Google's defenses was, we don't have to keep people who are upsetting the workplace, who cause a problem in the workplace. In an at-will employment scenario, yeah, sure. But then, when Damore filed suit, he produced enormous amount of screenshots and evidence of the way in which Google tolerated a ton of expression internally that was extraordinarily what you would call in outside, in the normal American discourse, pretty darn provocative against the right, pretty darn provocative about concepts like whiteness, et cetera. And so that's when you say, well, wait a minute, there's a culture here that is extremely disproportionate in that environment, in that community, against right-wing expression or against more conservative or libertarian expression. And that is a kind of culture that you see often in the academy. Now, does that say that doesn't happen on the right? As I said from the very beginning of this, one of the most disappointing aspects of the last several years to me as a former constitutional lawyer is this treatment of the Colin Kaepernick kneeling as a firing offense. When one of the greatest court opinions in the history of the United States of America is a 1942 opinion from the Supreme Court called West Virginia v. Barnett, where it dealt with Jehovah's Witnesses who refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. And in the middle of World War II, when the United States was facing existential threat, and the Supreme Court said, if there's any fixed star in our constitutional constellations, then no official high or petty can prescribe what is orthodox in law, politics, nationalism, religion. But here was the President of the United States trying to prescribe what was orthodox. And the right wing was,
What's even worse about that is there was a reality TV star who glorified groping female genitalia, and instead of being cancelled for actually admitting sexual harassment, was voted into the most powerful job in the world. And that's how screwed up this whole situation is. And then has gone on. I've got a list of 31 times Trump has tried to cancel either people or organizations. And I know you're obviously never Trumper, so you would agree with all that. I'm interested in what you think, David, about things like pro-life, because you talked about pro-life and to get it to a sort of slightly religious bent here. Would you say that people standing outside an abortion clinic or a family planning clinic with their placards attacking people as they walk in verbally and then lobbying their politicians to then get that place shut down, deplatformed, and to get that service cancelled in their state, do you think that qualifies as cancel culture?
Well, the pro-life argument is that that the act of abortion is killing a human being. So if the pro-life argument is philosophically and scientifically correct, yeah, I'm all for canceling killing. So it's there is a difference. Now, one of the things I've done in my life is also defend the rights of abortion advocates and those who are advocate for choice to enjoy all of the same First Amendment rights that I enjoy, all of the same rights of access to the public square that I enjoy. And I would not say that a university that brings a pro-choice speaker on campus, that pro-choice speech should be canceled. What you do is you rebut it. But I think the substance of the pro-life argument is that what's happening there is a killing of an innocent human being. And yeah, that killing should be canceled.
I guess really what this comes down to then is the importance of the Supreme Court of the United States. So every election is an election for the president. It's an election to who gets on the Supreme Court to make those, legal precedent cases, Roe versus Wade or whatever. So that's the importance of those cases. So then actually you can defer to the Supreme Court and say, actually, this is allowed by the law of the land. And so the way that you're going about trying to cancel this service is actually against what the legal system of this country has put in place, I guess. And that would be my issue. But people in America, you get people like Brian Kemp, who and his gubernatorial campaign, and you as a Republican or as a former Republican.
Former.
So his actual campaign was called Offends, right, to get elected. So this is the idea, the tribalistic nature between left and right. His actual election campaign was called Offends. And he said, this is his advert: I believe in God, family and country in that order. I say Merry Christmas and God bless you. I strongly support President Trump, our troops and ironclad borders. I stand for the national anthem. If any of this offends you, then I'm not your guy. If you're ready for a politically incorrect conservative, I'm Brian Kemp, and I'm asking for your vote. So it's a really fascinating way to do politics.
Obviously, it can be used, as you said, Jonathan, for people to use the supposed cancel culture on the right to kind of, stoke up support for them. But doesn't that kind of suggest that those who are genuinely on that very progressive left-wing cancel culture are simply playing into the hands, giving them a gift to the right by giving them this reason to actually, critique and to create this culture war.
So when it happens, yes. And as people like the great Michael Brooks, a great late, died recently, very sad about that. But some progressive voices, Anna Kasparian on the left, say this is a left when it happens. The whole sort of job should be to unify the left if we want to make progress and if we want things to happen. And when cancel culture happens genuinely, then this is a problem, and it is left eating itself when it happens on the left. I totally agree with that. Where the problem is when you have claims of cancel culture happening on the left, which when you dig down aren't cancel culture, they are something else, or they're lies.
Sure. Overblown.
And so that muddies the water.
Sure. We're going to go to a quick break, and I'll come back to you, David, because I do want to touch on, in a way, if this is a quasi-religious sort of phenomenon, whether there's any room for forgiveness or grace in this cancel culture. So we'll come to that in a moment's time. My guests on today's edition of Unbelievable are David French and Jonathan Pierce. Make sure to check out the links to their blogs from today's show as well. And we'll be back in just a moment's time. Yes, I know, you probably have an overflowing email inbox just like me. But there are some emails I really do want to read. If you like Unbelievable, I think you'll love our regular newsletter. You'll get updates, bonus content, all our articles and videos, plus automatic entry into prize giveaways. And if that's not enough, we'll even send you my free ebook when you sign up, In Conversation With, in which I share encounters with Jordan Peterson, Tim Keller, Richard Dawkins, and other significant thinkers. So join the conversation by going to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on newsletter. Go on, you know you want to. Hello and welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. We'll be continuing the debate on cancel culture with Jonathan Pierce and David French in just a moment's time. But if you can come back next week for the show, I've got an exciting discussion for you on free will. Is it an illusion? And does it matter if it is? Dan Barker and Braxton Hunter will join me to debate whether we are all ultimately determined by an atheistic universe, as Dan believes, or whether we have libertarian free will that points to God, as Braxton does. So look out for that coming your way next week on the show via podcast, radio, and of course YouTube as well. Now, I did mention last week that we were planning to launch an Unbelievable blog on the Pathos Network. You'll have to wait a little longer. We're just postponing that a couple more weeks as we put everything together for that. Look out for it, though, coming your way probably in mid-September. And you'll also be hearing about more ways you can connect with and support the show and some more resources we're making available this autumn. So it's exciting times for Unbelievable. Very glad to announce as well that Ruth Jackson is coming on board the good ship Unbelievable as well. She until recently was the editor of Premier Youth and Children's Work, but very glad to say she is coming into a full-time role with Unbelievable. Because we're doing so much more these days from the show, it's great that she'll be helping out in all kinds of different ways as a project manager, as a new face and voice as well for Unbelievable. You will have run into Ruth if you're a regular listener to the show, both on the podcast radio show, but also at our Unbelievable conferences and indeed at last year's Unbelievable USA conference. She's really passionate, especially about youth apologetics, so we're really hoping to make some great things happen on that front in coming weeks, months and years. So great to have Ruth on. We'll make sure to introduce her properly at some point very soon. Coming up straight after Unbelievable, by the way, this evening you can find the profile from 8 p.m. Always brilliant interviews with Christians from all walks of life. Had someone get in touch actually recently, Lisa, who's been catching up on the recent shows we've done on race relations and the church. She really enjoyed the shows with Dr. Yancey and Dr. Hart, and more of your feedback on that very shortly. But saying, I'm trying to find a reference you made to a black female apologist. I can't find the episode and don't remember her name. Do you know what I'm talking about and where I can find it? Almost certainly what you're talking about there, Lisa, is another Lisa, Lisa Fields, who was recently on the Profile podcast. She runs the Jude 3 Project, and she is a black female apologist out in the States. Fascinating interview, really good one, actually. So do look for the Profile podcast wherever you get your podcast from, and you'll find loads of other great interviews there as well. You also say, I haven't seen your beard, but frankly, I'm not a fan of beards. I find them unsanitary. Your vote has been cast on the beard, Lisa. Thank you very much. Lots of commentary coming in on the beard still these days whenever I pop up with it on a video or on the social medias. We'll get more of your feedback a little bit later on in the programme. But for now, let's get into the final part of this week's edition of the show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the show. We've been talking about cancel culture on Unbelievable today. My guests are David French and Jonathan Pierce. If you want more about David, then do check out thedispatch.com. That's his website. And he's the senior editor there. He's got a new book coming out actually in September. It's called, I'm searching for here, Divided We Fall. That's it. America's Secession Threat and How to Restore Our Nation. Thedispatch.com. And over on the Pathos Network, you can find Jonathan Pierce over at A Tippling Philosopher. And he's got a number of books that he's written as well. He's here on the YouTube channel. He's showing his branded mug. You know you've made it when you've got a branded mug. Look,
how bored you can get in lockdown.
It's been really fun talking through some of these issues and hearing the areas of agreement and disagreement you have on how severe this cancel culture is. It was notable that you penned a very personal blog recently, David, on a friend of yours, Mike Adams, who very sadly took his own life over the summer. Mm-hmm. And he was a divisive figure, it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Intentionally
so.
Indeed. And his most recent tweet before he passed away was a pretty, controversial tweet. No time to go into the ins and outs of it. But what you really wanted to draw out in this blog was that really we don't often realise the degree to which people are actually suffering, and even if there's a certain amount of bravado in the way they conduct themselves online, we need to be careful about the way we treat each other, because we're all human, we're all broken at the end of the day in different ways. And I wondered if you could speak to that just briefly, and we'll come back to Jonathan in a moment. A little bit of background to that, how it feeds into the discussion we've been having today about the way we do tend to so easily on social media shout each other down and jump to conclusions.
Yeah, I think social media is often almost like a perfect engine of dehumanization, because it is a very, very small window into a human being. And often when that window is entirely through maybe a series of tweets, or one tweet, or a series of tweets, or it creates it's often a completely out of context snapshot of a person's life, from which we draw conclusions that they're horrible human beings, and that they have no value being a professor, or in the case of my friend who took his own life, people were actually celebrating his death. And I knew him because I was his lawyer. I represented him in a case where his employer spent years and years violating his constitutional rights, and had taken punitive action against him on the basis of his protected speech in a way that clearly violated the Constitution. Advanced such a maximalist legal position that if they had won, it would have limited the constitutional rights of every professor, and which is one of the reasons why many progressive institutions like the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, intervened on his behalf in the case. And he won after a 7-year case. He won a jury trial. So there was a lot to him beyond his mean tweets. And, you know, one of the things that I consistently ask for online and elsewhere is grace, is tolerance. And you know, one of the things tolerance is a word that's misused a lot. Tolerance implies that there's something to tolerate, right? That there's something about a person that I'm tolerating. There's something about a person that offends me. And the ability to see their humanity across vast differences is absolutely key, not just to, sort of essentially building civil society, but the maintenance of a constitutional pluralistic republic. One of the things that I have seen in life is that liberty cannot over time survive enmity. That if you hate enough, eventually you'll reach a point where you want to yank even the basic liberties from the people you hate. And so, you know, at our highly polarized time, and I think Jonathan said something very insightful earlier, a lot of cancel culture, what we're really talking about is negative polarization. Negative polarization is this phenomenon in you see particularly in the U.S. where you're either Republican or a Democrat, not because you believe in your own side's views, but because you despise the other side. And that's, you know, the Kemp statements that you were, the Governor Kemp statements, Jonathan, you were reading earlier. This is a classic example of new GOP, which is it gains enormous strength from, quote unquote, triggering the libs, making the left angry. And it goes back to something else that you talked about earlier. Justin, you brought this up. each side thrives on opposition. The illiberal left and the illiberal right thrive on opposition, cross-ideological opposition. The illiberal left loves it if someone from the right attacks. The liberal right loves it if someone from the left attacks. But what causes, each side has to police its own. And you know, so that's why a lot of what you see is fratricidal. There is an intramural fight against the authoritarian right against the liberal right. There's a fratricidal fight, the authoritarian left against
David,
the liberal
left. I have a question on that, actually. So, and I know you were just about to go on to something else, so I apologize.
No, go ahead.
Talking about the left and right and these kind of pack mentality from these different positions, when you start getting Twitter being supposedly this location for the liberal left more than the right, and then the right start up Parlay as a kind of right-wing Twitter and Gab and all these other places, do you think we're actually just fragmenting into our own like echo chambers more and more, so that in fact we won't even be arguing at each other? We'll just be arguing about people who are over there, but I'm not actually talking to them. I'm talking about them to people who are like-minded around me.
I think we're cocooning within the major social media channels. So I think that these new social media platforms like Gab and Parlay are sideshows. Very, very few people are on them. Very few people participating with them on them daily compared to Twitter, Facebook. But what you're able to do on Twitter and Facebook is silo within those platforms. You're able to choose who you follow, who you block, and to the point where you can create your own echo chamber even within these platforms.
And frankly, Facebook will do it for you by just looking at the things you enjoy looking at and only feeding you those things thereafter, the algorithms.
And Twitter does it as well through suggested follows. Yeah. And so what you like and you favorite and you retweet all feeds into the machine and it spits back. And so you have to actually intentionally try to break it. So I intentionally follow about 50-50 left-right. I try to maintain a balance about 50-50 in my Twitter follows. And that's about the only way I've been able to get out of the siloing. And so we do have a lot of siloing. And this is a big part of the first part of my book. We don't just have siloing online. We have geographic cocooning. So that people are cocooning off in their own geographic communities. And one of the really interesting phenomenon that you see, and Cass Sunstein articulated this principle on more than 20 years ago. He called it the law of group polarization. And that's when people of like mind gather, their common view tends to get more extreme. And so think of it like this. If you're both of you are opposed to gun rights or you want more gun control, if you go to dinner with some other friends who are opposed to expanded gun rights and you all, you know, talk, at the end of the meal, you're going to be further entrenched in your position. If there's nobody there pushing back, this is just a human phenomenon. And we're getting into these communities where
how do we solve that then? I mean, you talk about humility, humble empathy, and forgiveness and mercy. How do you think we manufacture a scenario where we are engendering that in those in everything we do and the people around us?
You know, there's no easy answer to that because the cocooning is now growing so strong. But I will say this, I think that those of us who have a public voice, those of us who have a public platform, one thing that we can do is we can model the values we seek to advance in society. So that means reaching out across religious and ideological lines and having these conversations. That means not siloing ourselves. That means being able to, one of the things I tell audiences, stop reading everything that agrees with you and seek out the best expression of the opposing side's point of view. It requires intentional effort to reach out because the default of the algorithms, of the customized streaming services, of our own geography is to just have everything reinforce your view. And
confirmation bias is so prevalent. I think the question, how can I be wrong? How could I be wrong? I think is super important.
Well, and that goes back to, that's full circle to the existential humility point that we began this with.
It is indeed. I mean, we need to wrap up today's show. But in a way, we haven't really talked about very much at all the the religious differences between you both. You're a Christian, David. You're an atheist, obviously, Jonathan.
Yeah, David's wrong. I mean, that's really
and he's certain about it.
but we have been talking about what you deem a kind of quasi-religious phenomenon here, mm-hmm. David, the cancel culture, but one which you believe doesn't have the better parts of Christian faith, certainly, which is the idea of forgiveness and grace and so on, and mercy. Now, I don't know whether you agree with that, Jonathan, that we need a bit more, you know, a bit more what Jesus said, frankly, you know.
Love, yeah, you. I'm really interested in what you said. I'm so glad you said the better parts of the Christian faith, because what my issue was going to be, if David had brought up the whole idea of, you know, we need to take the lessons of forgiveness and mercy from the Bible, from the New Testament. And I'd say, that's great. I love that. However, it's cherry picking the Bible, and we get back to this whole idea of an atheist criticism of Christianity and the revelation that is the Bible, because of course there are all sorts of things condemned horribly and fundamentally and evangelically and authoritarianly in the Bible that if you are going to use that as your benchmark for behavior, then actually you could use it to represent the worst excesses of the far left and far right. And so, yes, by all means, choose the nice parts of the Bible, but just be very wary that you are cherry picking.
Well, we probably don't have a debate on the hermeneutical aspects of this. David, quick response and we'll wrap things up.
I look at it this way. I'll end it, since I'm the Christian here, with two Bible verses, both from Micah. I think of an individual mission statement as we encounter the culture that I already said, and I've used both of them already. Seek justice, love mercy, and walk humbly. As an individual mission statement, as a corporate mission statement of a government and a polity trying to figure out how we live through pluralism, to say, again, from George Washington, quoting Micah, repopularized in Hamilton, every man should sit under his own vine and fig tree and no one should make him afraid. These are attainable goals, not perfectly, of course, but in principle, they're attainable goals in our public discourse. They're attainable goals in our public policy. And it's how a diverse, continent-sized, multi-ethnic, multi-faith constitutional republic stays together.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Much more that could be said, but time is against us, gentlemen. Jonathan, thank you very much. Yes, please.
Can I just say one very final thing? It's lovely to hear David talk about a true desire for a pluralistic constitutional republic as a conservative that he is, that I just think that there's a lot to really, really herald in what he's saying and how he's going about things. And the very last thing, that he has no books behind him, so he's probably lost this.
I just have sports behind me. I'm a wannabe sports podcaster that no one wants to hear my sports takes.
Well, look, it's been such fun having you both on today. Thank you very much. A great discussion. And again, if you want to find out more about David, David is the senior editor at thedispatch.com. New book coming out soon, Divided We Fall. And over at Pathos, you're looking for a tippling philosopher if you want to get hold of Jonathan. But for the moment, thank you very much, folks, for joining me today.
Pleasure.
Thanks so much for having us.
Look forward to hearing what you made of today's show. Email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I read all the emails that come in. I can't respond to all of them, and I certainly can't read all of them out, but I do read them all. So do send it in that way, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also get in touch via our social media, @unbelievablejb for the Twitter account. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/unbelievablejb if you want the full way of getting there, or just search for Unbelievable ? And I'm available over on Instagram as well, justin.brierley. And let's get some short responses first of all to some of these recent shows on race and the church. Most of the response coming into the first show that we broadcast, which was between George Yancey and Drew Hart, debating specifically Black Lives Matter, the issue of white supremacy, race and the church. And Bruce tweets, a superb dialogue around race, BLM and a Christian response. The Unbelievable series facilitated by Justin on Premier is a gift to those who want to engage seriously with their faith In a Complex World. Thank you, Drew Hart and Professor Yancey, for your insights. So a lot of love for the show from Bruce. Andy Miller, the third, says, thanks, Justin, Drew and George, for letting us in on this thoughtful conversation. Nine Digit Eric says, I caught some of it and appreciated what I did hear. I find, though, there are often general agreements besides things I would agree with, but don't, because the supposition is based on incorrect or incomplete or overstated understanding. Still, I'm grateful for the opportunity to sit in. Trevor C, it was refreshing to hear from George that a lot of what people are wary of is justified and is unhelpful in unifying people and Christians in the fight against the voluntary introspection about how we as individuals educate ourselves on the impact of racism on black and minority ethnic groups. I also thought Drew's comparison between anti-racism and following Jesus's involving active, not passive discipleship was good. And thanks, Justin, for raising the topics as a positive framework for discussion. Gary Mabry says, I've been a constant follower of your show for over 10 years. Love how you handle difficult topics. But in this difficult area, facts are often misstated or twisted. I hope you continue covering this topic, but maybe with guests that are more objective. But you are the best in Christian podcasts. Jeffrey Jones, you deserve a lot of praise for hosting last weekend's episode of Unbelievable and today's. Bless you. Glenn Packiam, a great friend of the show, says, such a helpful conversation hosted by Justin with Drew Hart and George Yancey on the roots of a racialized society and white supremacy, the merits and limitations of D'Angelo's and Kendi's respective frameworks and key terms, and the dangers of a singular voice. And just reading your tweet there, Glenn, has reminded me, I never rescheduled that interview I was going to do with you on worship music. So forgive me. We'll try and make that happen. Robbie Emmett out in Oz wanted to say, really enjoyed it. Brilliant episode on racism. And while it was heartbreaking to hear some of the personal experiences of Drew Hart and George Yancey, both guests spoke beautifully, capturing the issue so well. Easily one of the best Unbelievable episodes ever. And that is very tough competition. Well, thank you very much for those. Not everyone quite so complimentary. David Howell says that while he really enjoyed the last two episodes, I think there is an important Christian perspective missing on these conversations on race. Unfortunately, the issue has been politicized by both sides and the reality has been lost. Christ is the answer. And I think the guys at the Just Thinking podcast do the best job of explaining the issues from a biblical worldview. I am aware of that podcast. In fact, I'd reached out to Daryl Harrison, one of the hosts, before we were set to record these episodes to see if he'd been interested in taking part. He didn't want to take part in a debate format. I am aware of what they do. Thank you for the suggestion. And just some longer responses that have come in on email as well. Here's James, who says, I am a Christian. I'm Hispanic, so consider myself a person of color. I am an American, and the United States has struggled with the ups and downs of race and ethnicity since our inception. For centuries, we've worked to improve race and ethnic relations. We're currently one of the least racist but most diverse countries in the world. Not the only one or the least racist, but one of them. Many people of diverse backgrounds, races, ethnicities, and religion want to come to the United States because of the opportunities available to all. Initially, I've had the view that if systemic racism exists in the US, pointed out, and we, almost everybody agrees, will work together to change that system. Of course, we all want to fight racism, but that said, please pray for me. I'm shutting down on the race message. I no longer listen to racial injustice organizations and speakers like Black Lives Matter, D'Angelo, Kendi, or Winfrey. The riots and looting throughout the country hurt the message. The justification and stories are often filled with lies. I no longer care, not because I don't care about people, but their language and method of communication does not work for me. It's off-putting, based on false premises and supported by lies. I'm hurting because I feel pushed towards apathy, even ire. Sorry to hear that from you, James. It's so sad to feel that you're that disillusioned with the current debate as it's being played out. Luke says, I'm a relatively new listener. I've really enjoyed my time listening to the show. Was sadly quite disappointed in this week's episode. Was hoping to hear some more nuanced discussion on the issues. Unfortunately, it seemed to be more of the same conversations that have been going on in the mainstream. Neither debater willing to question the underlying narratives being pushed. Both George and Drew are willing to make the same huge leaps of logic from anecdotal at best data that people like D'Angelo make without applying basic scholarship. As a young white man living in Canada, I was in many altercations with police. I received unjustified tickets, harassment, and prejudice because I was a young man, out late and obviously poor. My upbringing and location certainly provided me with more racial slurs being hurled my way than either of these scholars. I live in a mixed community of Aboriginals, Muslims, Asians and whites. My anecdotal experience, however, shouldn't be expanded out to represent every mixed race community. This type of cherry-picked analysis, however, is what both George and Drew are doing. Thank you very much, Luke. I get that. You don't feel that we can just extrapolate from anecdotal stuff. William is a believer in Louisiana, says, just listen to the podcast about Black Lives Matter. Just so happens that I wrote an article that my local newspaper published. It's about Black Lives Matter and Christianity. Love for you to read it if you have time. Well, I've just selected a segment of it here, William. This is some of what you say. Having quoted a lot from the Bible and why you believe it is ultimately the New Testament is all about social justice and getting to grips with that. You say, having gone back to the gospel, I see more than sufficient evidence that we need a movement to say Black Lives Matter. If you're going to tell us to have faith, then why denounce the work being done? No, I do not support everything that falls under the Black Lives Matter umbrella, but I will not pretend as though we haven't achieved results. Reform fighters are protesting not just in every state of America, but every country in the world. President Trump signed an order banning the use of chokeholds by officers. Precincts all across America are being defunded, some abolished altogether. Meaningful bills are being introduced on Capitol Hill, supported and written by the likes of Cory Booker and Kamala Harris. Regardless of how you feel about Black Lives Matter, you cannot deny results. I don't support the rioting, looting and destruction of property, but I also will not denounce it. Jesus himself overturned the tables of money exchanges inside the temple. Jesus couldn't stand to see what was being allowed to transpire inside his home and his father's home. America is our home. Why then do you complain when we overturn the statues erected to oppress us? We cannot stand to see what's being allowed to transpire in our home. Says William, thank you. And Greg Gruner says, while the current issues center on how whites have treated blacks, we must put this in the context of the flaws in human nature itself. Slavery is merely an example of the all-pervading fault in human nature, which the Bible calls sin. And of course, slavery was practiced long before Europeans enslaved blacks, blacks enslaved blacks, Arabs enslaved blacks. The Romans enslaved most of the races they conquered. We must be careful not to fall into the trap of thinking that overthrowing an oppressor via a revolution will somehow produce a utopia. That never happens because of the basic fault in humanity. The French Revolution overthrew King Louis, and they ended up with Robespierre and then Napoleon. The Russian Revolution overthrew the Tsar, and they ended up with Stalin. The only way that genuine peaceful change can happen, and happen it should, is for the non-violent approach espoused by Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Nelson Mandela. Unfortunately, from what I see, there is too much aggression, violence, and destruction carried out in the name of Black Lives Matter. And maybe just a couple more before we wrap up today's show. Zena gets in touch. I was interested in this one from Zena, saying, why are we, Africans and African Caribbeans, banging our heads against the brick wall of Christianity anyway? In my opinion, it's a religion that ancestrally isn't ours, and it's soul-destroying, putting our supernatural faith and seeking redemption in a place and space that was never meant for our ethnic group. Christianity was invented for Jews, appropriated by Anglo-Saxons, and people of African descent are just agonizing themselves trying to squeeze into the Christian space. We Africans, Caribbeans should give it a rest, and also stop calling us black people. We are Africans and Caribbeans. Wazena, fascinating sort of email from you. I'd be very open to hosting some kind of discussion, if you were open to it, on whether Christianity is sort of a white man's religion as such, which is obviously a criticism that has been put forward by lots of people in the things like the Black Consciousness Movement and so on. And perhaps someone like the aforementioned earlier on in the show, Lisa Fields, would be interested in discussing that with you. That's an objection she frequently engages with in her apologetics work. Okay, just one more. This is from Jessica, says, I don't think things will ever change, although some people are really fighting hard. But to me, I know we can fight and reduce the situation a bit. Sincerely speaking, though, there'll never be a complete change. A recent killing that has just happened with someone just walking away and getting gunned down with 7 bullets brings tears to my eyes. But if you can look at all these situations, I've not seen any white person going through this. Stop and search, being terrorized, God help us. But it will always remain the same. Even if someone doesn't say anything to you, the way they look at you is enough. You are black, period. Let's pray that maybe someday people will realize that we never created ourselves. We never chose to be what we are. And don't get me wrong, I love being black and I don't blame the creator, except I just ask him questions. Thanks for the battle and good luck. God bless you and all those who feel for us. Thank you very much. Many more responses, but we'll leave some for another show because, it'll be good to get some further points of view that have come in over the course of the last couple of weeks of shows. Thanks for all of those varied responses that have come into the programme. And again, you can send yours in via email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or go to the website and look up our social media at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. And the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, thanks for being with me this week. Let me tell you what's coming up next time. Is free will an illusion? And does it matter if it is? Well, Dan Barker and Braxton Hunter join me to debate whether we're all ultimately determined by an atheistic universe, that's what Dan believes, or whether we actually have libertarian free will that points to God, as Braxton does. All kinds of interesting ethical and rational sort of complications that arise from the if we get rid of free will as well. Those will be debated at some length on next week's show. Hope you've enjoyed today's show. Don't forget you can keep in touch via our newsletter. It's available from our website as well. For the moment, great to have you with me. See you next time.
You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.